fusarium in three powerful ways. 1. It attacks and destroys fusarium directly, feeding on it like a natural enemy. This reduces the fungal population in the soil over time. 2. It produces antifungal compounds that stop fusarium from growing. These natural chemicals create an environment where harmful fungi struggle to survive. 3. It strengthens plant roots, making them more resistant to infection. Healthier roots mean stronger plants, better yields, and less dependence on chemical treatments. Applying Trichoderma is easy. It comes in granules mixed into the soil or as a liquid sprayed onto roots. Farmers can integrate it into their existing planting and irrigation system with minimal effort. This eco-friendly solution works even in Iran's dry climate, especially in irrigated fields where fusarium thrives. Unlike chemical fungicides, Trichoderma is a sustainable option that improves soil health and long-term crop productivity.
One of the challenges we face in ensuring food security is controlling the damage caused by plant diseases. Annually, about 10% of agricultural production is lost due to contamination by pests and plant diseases, removing it from the food supply chain. Until now, chemical control methods have predominantly been used to manage the damage caused by pests and diseases. One eco-friendly approach that helps maintain ecosystem balance while ensuring sustainable disease control is biological control, which involves using a biological agent. An antagonist pathogen is the disease-causing agent that inflicts damage on crops. Microbial relationships are divided into two types: antagonism and symbiosis. Symbiotic organisms coexist, while antagonistic organisms oppose each other. We use an antagonist or natural enemy to control the damage caused by a disease or pathogen in a biocontrol method. On a commercial scale, the use of biocontrol methods often lacks popularity among farmers and producers compared to chemical methods, primarily due to the unavailability of effective biocontrol agents. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, through its Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, utilizes gamma radiation-induced mutation to enhance the antagonistic capabilities of these biocontrol agents. One well-known antagonist is the Trichoderma fungus. Trichoderma can naturally control a wide range of plant pathogens and diseases. However, to effectively use Trichoderma in managing plant disease damage, we need strains with high efficiency. Here, you can see an image of spores from a native strain of Ganoderma fungus isolated from soils in our country. When Trichoderma spores are exposed to gamma radiation, they may undergo genetic changes. Those genetic changes that increase the antagonistic power of Trichoderma are identified and isolated as desirable mutations by experts in microbiology laboratories. After exposing Trichoderma spores to gamma radiation, the DNA of the spores may undergo mutations under various scenarios. These scenarios could include nucleotide changes, such as inversion, translocation, or substitution. Each of these mutations can lead to new phenotypes and genotypes in the genetics of Trichoderma. To screen or select mutant strains resulting from gamma radiation, we utilize genetic markers based on the amplification of specific genomic regions or protein markers.
In the past year and a half that this lab has been working on producing this biofungicide, it has managed to produce roughly 3.5 tons of effective agent. Because as you know, any type of drug has an effective agent and a lot of carrier. In this case, the carrier makes up the vast majority of the weight, which has amounted to 35 tons of pesticides not being imported into the country because, you know, the most common, most accessible way of dealing with this fusarium-based pathogens has been to just use pesticide, which we've already talked about just how many negative effects it can have on the soil, the environment as a whole, and on the farmers who are using these pesticides. So it has prevented the use of 35 tons of pesticide, and it has been able to do that with the same amount of effectiveness as a pesticide. So with the reduced cost of making it, there's really no reason to go back to using pesticides. So hopefully they keep doing what they're doing and be able to cover more ground when it comes to soil-borne diseases, if there is any left. And with that said, I think that's going to be it for this week's episode of Iran Tech. I'll see you guys next week.
يا أول كل شيء وآخر.
We're not in the front lines out there. We're not being targeted. What we can do is create awareness.
If you look at the human race, there is one thing that we all unanimously agree, that in order to succeed in this world, one has to struggle.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Please stay with us. يا إله كل شيء ومليك يا رب كل شيء وسانع يا خالق كل شيء. Today's tip: how much pressure should we put on ourselves while we conduct our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah? So, dear listeners, we are humbly at your service here on Foresight, talking about something which is quite important, and that is how much pressure should we put on ourselves when it comes to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Now, this is something that most probably we have asked ourselves, or we have asked somebody else about, is how much pressure should we put on ourselves when it comes to conducting our ubudiyya, doing our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, you know, first and foremost, we need to realize that we should put pressure on ourselves in order to conduct the various forms of ubudiyya, worship and servitude and obedience to Allah. So I think we should start with the things that are wajib, the things that are obligatory, and the things that are haram, the things that are prohibited. Now, when it comes to the wajib things, the things that are obligatory, and when it comes to the haram things, the things that are prohibited, we should put the utmost pressure on ourselves to do the wajib things and to not do the haram things, right? So these are two aspects in which we do need to put pressure on ourselves, right? Now, when it comes to the recommended things, the things that are mustahab, they are recommended, or the things that are makruh, it is better to not do those things, they are makruh. In these fields, we don't need to put as much pressure, at least in the initial stages of spiritual wayfaring. And of course, the things that are mubah, that they are neutral, you know, there is a neither for or against, well, you know, that is even a, you know, last part of where we should be putting our pressure on. So we should put pressure on ourselves when it comes to the, for example, five daily prayers. Now, of course, this also depends. Everything needs to be in balance. So, for example, if for whatever reason, God forbid, we're not doing any of the five daily prayers, well, we probably should not put pressure on ourselves that from tomorrow, we're going to read all five with the utmost pressure. Everybody needs to gauge themselves and be sincere with themselves as well. So sometimes we have a tendency to fool ourselves and say, you know, I can only do one prayer a day for the next 6 months until I get to the second prayer. Now, maybe there's somebody out there like that, but I highly doubt it. Most of us should not fool ourselves. We should be sincere, you know, that, okay, tomorrow I will at least pray one prayer. And the next day I will pray, you know, two prayers. And the next day I will pray three prayers. Or tomorrow I will do four. Or tomorrow. And in this manner, we need to put pressure on ourselves so that we start doing at least the wajib prayers. When it comes to fasting, you know, if for some reason we haven't fasted in our lives, well, this holy month of Ramadan, we are going to, the first week, we're going to fast, right? And gauge yourself. The point of what I'm trying to make is sometimes if we put too much pressure on ourselves, we aren't able to do anything. And this itself is one of the tricks of Satan, is to somehow, you know, have us put so much pressure on ourselves. And even if it isn't Satan, even if we have a positive, you know, outlook, or we have a good intention, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. And what that does is that ends up breaking us. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
We're not in the front lines out there. We're not being targeted. What we can do is create awareness. But that awareness has to come within first. And part of that process is to adopt the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt. One seerah of the Ahlul Bayt that we have to understand in this era of the ghibat of the Imam is the ability to turn hardship into worship. It's not going to get any easier. Our fifth Imam says that if the individuals knew the events that would lead towards the zuhur of my grandson, they wouldn't want to be alive during that time. Amir al-Mu'mineen was hit with a poisonous sword on the morning of the 19th of Ramadan. He said one phrase. "Stubira bil Ka'aba" is a very famous statement, he says. I would say, Amir al-Mu'mineen, you were the one that destroyed 70 kuffar in Badr. You were the one that ripped the door of Khaybar. You were the one that killed Amr ibn Abdaud. You were the one that the Prophet said, "You kullu iman in Jang Khandak." You were 33 years old in Ghadir, but nowhere do we hear the announcement of the success of Amir al-Mu'mineen. When he was hit with the sword, he announced his success. The hardship of that moment turned into the worship of Amir al-Mu'mineen. You asked the sister Imam Hussein, Bibi Zainab, salamullah alayha, that how did you find the day of Ashura? Imam Hussein's mission of Karbala ended on Asr Ashur, physically at least. She took that and she continued it all the way back to Medina. It's not easy to take 200 plus kids on that journey. It's not easy to take Imamah on your back across that journey, but she did that. And she witnessed everything from the shahadat of her own sons, her own nephews, her own brother, everything. And when she was asked, she simply said, "What? Ma ra'aytuhu illa jamila." I saw nothing on that day but beauty. Can you imagine for a moment? Watch your brother who has been with you since day number one, 200 plus arrows in his body. And you're witnessing that with your own eyes. And you equate that to beauty? Ma ra'aytu illa jamila. Hardship into worship.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how much pressure to put on ourselves when it comes to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So we said that, you know, we have to be careful because sometimes, yes, we have this really good energy and we have this very positive outlook and this good niyyah, this good intention, you know, and we end up putting so much pressure on ourselves and we end up burdening ourselves so much that we cannot bear that pressure, sometimes because we're young, sometimes because we're inexperienced, or sometimes because, you know, we don't know what exactly is going on. And so many of these spiritual wayfaring masters, they have told us that in whatever stage of this spiritual wayfaring that one is, this ubudiyya that an individual is in, this worship, this servitude, and this obedience to the Almighty Allah, is to always be aware of what condition their soul is in and to try to be kind and have a caring outlook to one's soul and avoid burdening it more than it can bear. Because if we put too much pressure, then it'll end up breaking. But that does not mean that we shouldn't put any pressure. Now, when it comes to the haram things and the prohibited things, we can't just be like, okay, I'm not going to put any pressure. I'm going to go ahead and, God forbid, I'm just going to drink, you know, one bottle of alcohol. No, we, in that situation, we have to put a lot of pressure on ourselves and we need to stop, you know, and realize that these things are haram. But in other things, you know, for example, things that are not haram, we don't necessarily have to put too much pressure. So we have to, at the end of the day, I think, be sincere with ourselves, be sincere with the Almighty Allah. Our intention must be sincere. And we have to remember that these things are processes. They happen over a long period of time, you know. And yes, you know, we can't just, you know, be kind of lazy for the fajr, the morning pre-dawn prayers, right? We can't just be like, well, I'm tired. I'm not going to put pressure on myself, you know, put the alarm on snooze. That's not being sincere with ourselves, and it's not being sincere with the Almighty Allah. And if we are sincere with ourselves, especially when we realize that this is something which will build our hereafter, it will build our eternal home. And it is something that is required from us by the Almighty Allah for our benefit. Then we will start to put pressure on ourselves and we will try and we will struggle. You know, one of the very general meanings of jihad is struggle, is to fight, is to work hard, is to be tireless in our efforts and struggle, you know, in order to walk this path of the Almighty Allah and this path of ubudiyya, the worship, the servitude, and the obedience to Allah.
Muhammad, ya Rasul Allah, ya Habib Allah, ya Khalil Allah, Muhammad.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
If you look at the human race, there is one thing that we all unanimously agree, that in order to succeed in this world, one has to struggle. And we actually honor people when they struggle, because a lazy person, a person who takes shortcuts, is not a very progressive individual. So we understand that as a reality in our existence. Having said that, when God asks us to sacrifice, that's in line with this reality. And therefore we find that when a person is willing to sacrifice, it's a very positive situation, it's not negative. In fact, the term love, which we all like to use very much, when we say we love you, we love the world, it's a loving world. The word love is a very positive term generally, but we find love is meaningless if the word and the reality of sacrifice is not in line with it, juxtaposition with it. So one can never say that I love you without being willing to sacrifice. So sacrifice and love are synonymous terms that cannot be replaced. So having said that, when God asks us to sacrifice, it's not to cause harm and struggle upon us, unnecessary struggle, but it is to prove the point of love, and that position of love has a direct position with one's ability to sacrifice, which is why God is demanding sacrifices from us.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Take pieces of bread from me, and your soul will never be broken. And if I am your haven, you will never be homeless. One whose cloak is me will never be naked. And one whose resort is me will never be destitute. God is above all powers. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Brothers, sisters, listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, and welcome to the program مفاتيح الحياة, Keys of Life. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi. We were discussing scholars. We have a hadith from the Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. He says, من عمل على غير علم كان ما يفسد أكثر مما يصلح. He said, when it comes to those who are scholarly and those who work without knowledge, sometimes a person is ignorant himself and he doesn't know what he's doing, and whatever he does obviously will backfire at him. And sometimes when you act based on knowledge, obviously it should make a difference. So the hadith, he says, من عمل على غير علم, when someone works and does things without knowing. Now that's a problem, because what happens is, he said, يفسد, what you would corrupt, what you would break, more than that you could mend and fix and rectify.
And therefore, we have to be very careful that to understand our amal, our knowledge, it needs to be practical and useful. Otherwise, we will put ourselves in trouble. Look at this hadith. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, إن أهل النار ليتأذون من ريح العالم التارك لعلمه. The people of hellfire, they themselves, they get hurt and annoyed by the scholar who is thrown in hellfire. Why? Because he did not apply his knowledge. Now, I don't know, but that seems to me that these scholars, they have more punishment than sinners themselves. So we have to be very, very careful when it comes to ulama. Ilm itself requires amal, requires practice, requires applying. To sit and give theories is very easy. For me to just to sit around and teach people and preach to people is quite easy. But when I'm not applying it, is a problem. That in the dunya, in this world, I might be able to get away with it. But in the hereafter, it's going to be a problem. I can't escape the consequences of my actions in this world. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, he says, لا يستوي عند الله في العقوبة الذين يعملون والذين لا يعلمون. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not, in, he says, in the sight of Allah, those who know and those who do not know, is they not equal in the sight of Allah? Obviously, there's a difference. نَفَعَنَ اللَّهُ وَإِيَّاكُمْ بِمَا عَلَّمَنَا. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increases our knowledge in whatever He has given us. وَجَعَلَهُ لِوَجْهِهِ خَالِصًا. And may Allah make this is sincerely just for His sake. إِنَّهُ سَمِيعٌ مُجِيبٌ. This is the dua of Amir al-Mu'mineen. After saying that, when it comes to punishment, that those who know and those who don't would differ. So sometimes those who know get more punishment than those who don't. Because those who don't, they just don't. They will get a punishment, but much less than those who know, but never applied. Let us take a short break, and then we will come back.
آیت الله جوادی آملی, the author of the book مفاتیح الحیات, the keys of life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه, چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book مفاتیح ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است, چه فرم دماغ و سواب داره فرم روزون است.
One volume, the present volume مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرونت رخکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره, دعا هم داره, ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program مفاتيح الحياة, Keys of Life. We said that the punishment between the scholars and non-scholars are different. Scholars will get more punishment. And one might wonder, why would the scholar get more punishment than someone who is not a scholar? who are in the same, you know, because we said if they're both in hell, those who are in hell will be complaining about the order and the evil and bad punishment of the alim that is with them in hell. The Prophet Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he says, "Zallatul alimi kankisar as-safina." When a scholar, a knowledgeable person, slips and makes a mistake, what happens? He says, in the same way when a ship breaks down. What happens when this ship, if the ship is sailing in the middle of the ocean and it breaks down, what happens is the ship itself will sink. And whoever is on board of that ship will sink too with it. No question about that. A'alim is that ship. The scholar is that ship. Once the scholar himself sinks, he will take with him all those who've been following him, listening to him. That's where the problem lies. So if we have a scholar, if we have a marja, for example, who has thousands and hundreds of thousands, millions of people following him, and this person, at some stage of his life, he becomes corrupted ideologically. He changes his mind regarding things, regarding the Ahl al-Bayt, regarding the Quran, regarding the Hadith. I don't know. He changes, and he keeps coming up with new theories, new ideas, and he uses his scholarly way in trying to convince people that what he's saying is true. And maybe a lot of people, a lot of youth, will fall for that. Now, he has broken what he did. He took everyone with him. He drowned, and he drowned everyone with him. Therefore, the punishment would be much more severe. It is stated that a story in Benu Israel, it said that one day a person claimed to be a prophet, and he preached his prophethood, and people accepted him. And they said, you know what? Whatever you say makes a lot of sense. And after a while, he started getting more supporters and more people following him. And, you know, he became viral, as we say. After a while, this man sat down with himself, and he realized what he did was a grave, grave sin. That he's claiming to be a prophet of Allah, inviting people to a new religion, and what have you. So he felt very scared. So he repented. And then he went to one of the prophets of his time. He said to him, look, this is what I've done, and I want Allah to forgive me. This prophet speaks to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and Allah tells him, listen, tell this person, I will forgive him under one condition. And that is, he has to go back and convince everyone that believed in him that what he did was wrong and he's not a true prophet. And then they have to go back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If that happens, then I will forgive him. That's why scholars, they are like a ship, in the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. If it breaks, it will drown, and will drown everyone with it. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Street.
Part 1.
This is the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the Gate of Tears, and one of the most vital maritime channels in the world.
Most cargo operators now won't send their boats through the strait connecting the Red Sea with the Gulf of Aden. That's known as the Gates of Grief.
12% of the world's maritime trade is carried out through the Suez Canal and all ships passing through this canal must pass through the Bab el-Mandab Strait, an area that has become the scene of a major international naval battle over the past year. It all started with Al-Aqsa flood operation and the beginning of the brutal Israeli aggression on Gaza. And since that date on, every week the world heard news of Israeli ships or their Western supporters being targeted in the north and south of the Bab el-Mandab Strait. Shipping companies that were in contact with the Zionist regime had two choices: to reroute around the southern tip of the African continent and make the route longer, or to accept the risk of the Ansarallah missile attacks or even the seizure of their ships in retaliation for the widespread support of Western countries for the Zionist regime's aggression against the Gaza Strip.
To put that in perspective, 90% of the world's goods, or somewhere between 70 and 90% of all the world's goods, are transported
by ship.
Yep. Okay, so 10 to 12% of that entire global effort is transiting through the Red Sea in this narrow strait.
8% of LNG, I think like 8% of grain, and I think 12% of oil. LNG actually stopped completely going through there. We haven't had an LNG ship go through since, I believe, January of this year. But the first one had a successful transit last week.
The Bab el-Mandab Strait is a major transit route between the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe, with about 15% of global maritime trade and 30% of the world's container traffic passing through it. As of November 2023, 500,000 containers pass through the Bab el-Mandab Strait daily.
So, Tad, the Bab el-Mandab is actually Suez Canal.
Right.
If you're going to go through the Suez Canal, you're going to go through the Bab el-Mandab. But so it's absolutely important. It's one of the three key choke points in the Central Command region: the Suez Canal, the Bab el-Mandab, and, of course, the Strait of Hormuz.
Any disruption to maritime security in the Bab el-Mandab Strait would put a huge strain on major global shipping companies and consequently on global maritime trade. If commercial ships were to be cut off from the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the alternative route would be to circumnavigate the African continent and pass through the Cape of Good Hope in the south of the continent, which would lengthen the route by about 3,500 nautical miles and increase the time it takes to transport goods by sea from origin to destination by an average of 10 days, which would increase the ship's fuel consumption by 33%.
Yes, Salmi. Well, this is all about the Suez Canal. That Red Sea is the entrance to that, and that's what the commercial shippers now are, obviously, if they're not going through there, going all the way around Africa, and that's going to impact global economy.
A few years ago, this problem occurred on a smaller scale in another maritime passage. On March 23, 2011, the Suez Canal was closed for a week until March 29th due to the grounding of the container ship, the Ever Given, which left 15 ships at harbor and at least 237 ships waiting to pass through the canal, resulting in the freezing of trade worth over $9 billion a day. Land routes can never be a substitute for strategic passages such as the Bab el-Mandab Strait or the Suez Canal because of limitations such as the volume of goods carried, border and customs problems, and the presence of a large number of countries along the route. These cases show the importance of the Gulf of Aden, the Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Red Sea for global trade, and the slightest incident affects the entire world and directly or indirectly involves many countries.
It's important to differentiate between what's happening between Israel and Hamas and what's happening in the Red Sea.
Given the high importance of the Bab el-Mandab Strait in global maritime trade for several decades, the world's major powers and countries on the strait's periphery have been trying to gain military dominance over this strategic waterway and have spent relatively large budgets to establish permanent or temporary military bases in this area.
We're witnessing one of the largest shifts in global geostrategic power that the world is witnessing.
Among foreign countries competing in the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the United Arab Emirates has made great effort to expand its military operations in countries that surround the strait. The most important bases of the UAE's army include the island of Socotra and several naval bases in the port cities of Aden and Mocha in southern Yemen, two military bases in Somalia, and one base in Eritrea and Djibouti, and efforts to establish a presence on the coast of Sudan. The Emiratis made great efforts to achieve complete military dominance over this strategic waterway by dominating the ports of southern Yemen and the islands of Socotra and Mayoun. However, Ansarullah's resistance and heavy attacks on UAE interests in this area have prevented Abu Dhabi from fully realizing this goal. Abu Dhabi's partner, and in some cases, long-standing rival in this regard, is Saudi Arabia, which has been developing its naval fleet centered on the port of Jeddah for several years due to its long coastline on the Red Sea. And on the other hand, it also has military presence in Djibouti alongside some regional and supra-regional powers. For the Saudi rulers, dominating the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandab was a way to escape the geopolitical deadlock and excessive dependence on the Strait of Hormuz, but to this day, they have not succeeded in doing so, and all three of their maritime access routes, namely the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Suez Canal, are controlled by their rival powers. Turkey, which has been pursuing its strategic development plans from the Caucasus to North Africa since Erdogan's rule, is one of the new powers that has been trying to establish an active military presence in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandab Strait in recent years. The Turkish army currently has military bases in Somalia and Sudan. Several European countries, including Britain, France, and Spain, have also increased their activities in the Red Sea region over the past decade, centered on the French military base in Djibouti. Over time, other European Union countries have also joined the French base, as 70% of the EU's imports pass through the Red Sea.
Djibouti is very important. We use it, as you noted, as a base. Mm-hmm. Others, friends and others, use it as a base as well. Mm-hmm. It's important because we also base other kinds of maritime reconnaissance aircraft there.
Djibouti's strategic location in the Horn of Africa has led two East Asian players to establish military bases in the country. One of these two countries is Japan, which has been establishing a permanent military base in Djibouti since 2011. This is the first military base away from home that Japan has established since the Second World War. With China's increasing power in global trade and the rapid development of its naval fleet, the Chinese also established their base in Djibouti in 2016. Thanks to its heavy investment in the African continent and to protect its commercial interests, especially based on the One Belt, One Road mega project, China has a great need to maintain the security of the Red Sea region, and this requires a permanent military presence, especially a port capable of receiving heavy naval vessels of the country's navy. Although the Zionist regime has a very narrow coastline in the Gulf of Aqaba on the way to the Red Sea, in the past decades, they've tried to expand their strategic depth of access to the sea from the southern part of the occupied territories by expanding their military and security presence on the islands of the southern Red Sea, such as Dahlak and Perim, as well as a secret spy and telecommunications interception base at Mount Embo Soira in the Eritrean territory.
The Houthis have achieved something, if nothing more than they've caused everyone to recognize the fact that they can, in fact, impact a very strategic area with almost nothing.
The Zionists have long sought to control the Mediterranean-Red Sea maritime trade route in order to secure common interests with Western countries. The big Suez Canal crisis in 1956, with the joint attack of Israel, France, and Britain to regain control of the canal, and the big Yom Kippur War of 1973 with the Egyptian and Syrian armies, were among the important steps taken by the Zionist regime in this direction. Finally, the largest military presence among foreign countries, as expected, is that of the United States, which, thanks to its largest military base in Djibouti and the pretext of fighting Somali pirates, has deployed a large number of its vessels at sea and its aircraft and combat forces in African countries bordering the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden for two decades.
The Houthis shut down maritime traffic in the Red Sea. The United States declares Operation Prosperity Guardian. We're going, United States is going, we got a carrier task force, we got destroyers, we got cruisers, we got NATO partners. By God, Houthis, watch out now. Here we come. And what happened? Carrier task force group is pulled out. Yeah, still got some destroyers there. And who has shut down the Red Sea? The Houthis. Can't stop the Houthis.
But despite the fierce competition between various world powers for military presence in the countries of the Horn of Africa and the outskirts of the Bab el-Mandab Strait, without dominating the coasts of Yemen or at least establishing a partnership with the ruling power in this country and ensuring the security of the sea route north and south of the Bab el-Mandab Strait, all the aforementioned efforts for military presence in the Red Sea will almost be fruitless. This bitter truth was well understood by Western countries, and especially the Zionist entity, in the events that occurred over the past year.
They said explicitly and repeatedly that that was in defense of the Palestinian people who were being attacked by Israel.
The Yemeni people have been under colonial rule and domination by powers such as the Ottomans, Britain, the Soviet Union, the United States, and Saudi Arabia for over 100 years. But thanks to the emergence of the Ansarullah movement and its control over the capital and the western coasts of Yemen, it is now the will and decision of the Yemenis that determines safe passage through the Bab el-Mandab Strait. Any country whose actions are against the interests of the Yemeni people and the member states of the Axis of Resistance will not be allowed to safely transit its ships through the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandab Strait.
When it comes to the Houthis, yes, they have ballistic missiles, and that is a significant capability.
On October 7th, 2023, the Palestinian Resistance Movement carried out Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, inflicting the greatest military security shock on the Zionist entity since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. The extremely high volume of Israeli casualties and captives transferred to the Gaza Strip had devastating effects on the Zionist regime militarily and socially. Zionists carried out brutal bombing and major crimes against the oppressed Palestinian people in a different way than in previous battles, and this caused other resistance groups in the region to come to the aid of the Palestinian fighters in the Gaza Strip. Despite the distance of more than 1,800 kilometers to the occupied territories, the Yemeni army and popular forces demonstrated a very active and uninterrupted participation in supporting the Palestinian cause and the resistance. Given their access to the West Coast and very convenient access to the center and south of the Red Sea, the Yemeni Ansarullah had the ability to attack the south of occupied territories while at the same time having a relatively large arsenal of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and suicide drones, and played a special role in pressuring the Zionist regime. The first attacks by the Yemeni Ansarullah movement began on October 19, 2023, which was a combined attack with cruise missiles, attacks on ground targets, and suicide drones. Without U.S. military assistance, the Israeli military was unable to cover the south of the occupied territories because it was simultaneously busy attacking the Gaza Strip and fighting with the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah on the northern front.
I think it's really quite shameful that the administration is likely waiting until soldiers or sailors get killed in this. I mean, the idea of having a military is to deter. And when your adversary is escalating, then you have to take action to deter them from further escalation. And that is what we have failed to do here.
Therefore, from the very beginning of the Yemeni army's attacks on the port of Eilat, the U.S. Navy took direct action to defend the Zionist regime, for instance, claiming it had shot down 4 cruise missiles and 15 Yemeni drones on the same day. However, the volume of Yemeni army attacks on the south of the occupied territories and commercial ships affiliated with the Zionist entity in the Red Sea gradually increased, and the Americans were no longer able to counter these attacks alone. On December 18, 2023, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the formation of an international naval coalition to counter the Ansarullah's attacks, dubbed Operation Prosperity Guardian.
Regarding the Houthis, these attacks are reckless, dangerous, and they violate international law. And so we're taking action to build an international coalition to address this threat.
The coalition was formed with more than 20 members, but only the United States, the UK, Germany, Denmark, and Sri Lanka had warships in the conflict zone.
It's clear that this type of behavior can't be met without a response. We need to send a strong signal that this breach of international law is wrong. People can't act like this with impunity, and that's why, together with allies, we've decided to take this action.
The European countries of France, Italy, and Spain, along with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, refused to join the coalition and announced that they will independently escort commercial ships and counter Ansarullah missile and drone attacks. Also, according to many security and media sources, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have helped the Zionist regime to initially detect missiles and drones fired from Yemen into occupied territories and even in some cases intercepted and destroyed them. In January of 2024, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2722 condemning the Ansarullah attacks in the Red Sea. Although one of the main points of this resolution was the efforts of all parties to the conflict to reduce the level of tension in the region, the United States and Britain abused the resolution and launched illegal airstrikes on Yemeni territory.
The U.S. says tonight that it is not interested in a war with Yemen, just hours after American and British missiles hit Houthi rebel positions there.
A massive naval and air campaign against the Yemeni army, an army that had been engaged in internal conflict with the Saudi and Emirati armies and their mercenaries for years, and now it was ready to fight a coalition with a strong leadership that had never been defeated in international waters. Although many countries were trying to escort ships and ensure their safety as they passed through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the sum of all their assets combined was not as much as that of the United States. The U.S. Navy has at various times deployed two aircraft carrier groups with maximum possible operational capacity in the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea, the aircraft carrier the Eisenhower and the amphibious assault ship the Bataan. Each of these two groups also included several destroyers, support ships, and nuclear submarines, the most famous of which were the destroyers the Mason, the Kearney, and Laboon of the Arleigh Burke class, which recorded the most experience of engaging with missiles and drones fired from Yemen. The U.S. aircraft carriers are equipped with advanced F-35, F-18, and Harrier, as well as Poseidon Maritime Patrol and E-2 Hawkeye aircraft.
So what I saw there, you know, during my time as the Maritime Operations Center Director, the Houthis are not launching these one at a time. They're launching them in swarms. And then shortly behind the UAV would be a cruise missile. Or a ballistic missile, and I call them ballistic missiles, but we have to understand what's happening in the theater. They're not flying a ballistic trajectory. They're not going exo-atmospheric. Mm. It's the speed associated with it, but the Houthis have depressed the trajectory, and these missiles are getting out to the battle space fairly quickly. If a ballistic missile is fired from the typical launching points that we've seen, the ships have anywhere from 15 to 20 seconds.
While each escort destroyer carries more than 100 defensive missiles to counter attacks by the Yemeni army or Tomahawk cruise missiles to attack deep inside Yemeni territory, dozens of MQ-9 Reaper drones also conduct reconnaissance flights from nearby bases over Yemeni territory or Red Sea waters. According to the direct admission of the Commander-in-Chief of U.S. naval forces in the region, the U.S. Navy has never experienced such a combat formation for such a long time since World War II.
How many sailors are now in the Red Sea?
Yeah, we've got about 7,000 right now. So it's a large commitment.
When was the last time that the U.S. Navy operated at this pace for a couple months?
I think you'd have to go back to World War II, where you have ships who are engaged in combat. When I say engaged in combat, where they're getting shot at, we're getting shot at, and we're shooting back.
This is while large numbers of ships from European countries and the Royal Air Force's Eurofighter Typhoon fighter jets are also engaged in escorting commercial ships and carrying out attacks on Yemeni territory.
The Houthis are the first entity in the history of the world to use anti-ship ballistic missiles ever firing against shipping.
No one has ever used
an anti-ship ballistic missile, certainly against commercial shipping, much less against U.S. Navy ships. If there is an anti-ship ballistic missile launch, this ballistic missile travels at about Mach 5, about 3,000 miles an hour.
How much time is there between a Houthi launch and then it could reach a U.S. ship?
If it's coming toward them, now just put yourself in the seat of the destroyer captain on that ship. He has about 9 to 15 seconds to make a decision that they're going to shoot that down. It's intense.
The U.S. military has also made extensive use of its military bases in West Asia to direct attacks against Yemen.